Hi, it's Deanna. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you about an exciting opportunity at RAND's Graduate School. We're launching a new Master of National Security Policy program. This is a one academic year program that equips students with the skills to grow or launch their careers as foreign and national policy practitioners, researchers, and more. All academic backgrounds are welcome. Students in the program will learn from leading experts who are shaping national security issues. They'll gain real-world insights from faculty working with the White House, the Pentagon, and U.S. intelligence agencies. Students will conduct research and analysis on critical national security challenges, and they'll develop expertise in topics like the defense acquisition process, national strategy, and space policy. Full-time and part-time options are available to support your schedule. We have campuses in the Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles areas, and we offer generous scholarships. You can learn more at www.rand.org/national security. Okay, here's today's show.
You are listening to Policy Currents, a weekly podcast from RAND. I'm Evan Banks.
And I'm Deanna Lee. Every Friday, we bring you new insights from RAND's latest research and commentary. It's July 12th.
The NATO summit here in Washington, D.C. wrapped up yesterday. In case you missed it on Monday, we had a special episode all about NATO, featuring dozens of insights from our experts about the future of the alliance. Insights that are still very relevant now. So I'd encourage you to check that episode out if you haven't already. But we'll start off today's show with some more thoughts on NATO from our researchers that we weren't able to cover on Monday. Up first, NATO's strategy toward Russia. Alliance leaders seem likely to recommit to what's called a containment plus policy toward Moscow. That's according to RAND's John Teft and William Courtney, both of whom are former U.S. ambassadors. Such an approach seeks to stop or limit some of Russia's harmful activities through sanctions and other measures. Containment Plus also pushes back against Russia's occupation of parts of Ukraine. For instance, Washington recently allowed Kyiv to fire U.S.-produced weapons at military forces in Russia that are attacking or about to attack Ukraine. Teft and Courtney say that this is the right strategy, so long as, quote, Russia is ruled by a regime as aggressive and oppressive as President Vladimir Putin's. And, in fact, it's a similar strategy that was employed four decades ago, when the USSR invaded Afghanistan, threatened militarily to suppress a popular movement for more freedoms in Poland, and secretly deployed a new intermediate-range missile against Europe and Japan. Today's threats bear striking similarities. In addition to Russia's ongoing offensive in Ukraine, the Kremlin has ramped up its nuclear threats, and it appears to be taking steps to develop a more efficient military sector. Further, Russia has succeeded in evading some sanctions, has stepped up its subterfuge against NATO members in Europe, and is cultivating ties with China. Because of these challenges, Teft and Courtney conclude that the alliance must devise, quote, new approaches to deal with Moscow's rogue behavior and an international order that is becoming more complex and less stable.
Sticking with NATO, in the debate over burden sharing, what each member state contributes to the collective defense, one number has come to dominate the conversation, 2%. That's how much each ally has pledged to spend on defense as a share of its economy. 18 of NATO's 32 member states are on track to hit that target this year, up from 11 last year. But that 2% number has never been a great metric. Consider, for instance, that a country could theoretically spend tens of billions of dollars on combat boots and clear that threshold without really making the world any safer. This problem led RAND researchers to come up with a more objective way to measure burden sharing among allies. They collected data on how many troops, tanks, and tactical aircraft each country has. They counted every satellite, every submarine, every drone, helicopter, and piece of artillery. They factored in overall spending levels, but also the cost of peacekeeping missions and the exports lost to enforcing sanctions. When they were done, they had an index that shows not just how much each country spends, but what it can actually bring to the table in time of war, such as personnel, aircraft, or artillery. The researchers included all NATO countries, as well as several Asian countries that also have collective defense treaties with the United States. Unsurprisingly, the U.S. is by far the biggest contributor to NATO, bearing around 47% of the total burden. But it's not as lopsided as it might seem. In fact, 47% was actually less than commonly assumed. Further, our numbers predate Russia's war in Ukraine, which has spurred almost every NATO country in Europe to ramp up its defense spending. The index also revealed 20 countries in Europe and Asia that could be called upon to contribute more. The publicly available report doesn't name names, but the details can help U.S. and NATO leaders to identify shortfalls and make targeted requests to the countries best suited to address them. For instance, a country might have a low overall score on the index, but a relatively high score in one specific capability that would be valuable in almost any future conflict, say tanker aircraft. NATO could push that country to not just increase its spending, but to invest the money in doing what it does best, building tankers. NATO could also call on lower scoring countries to take the lead on entirely new capabilities, like advanced drones. Lead researcher on the project, King Mallory, noted that there's one other reason to think carefully about what countries are really contributing to the collective defense. Quote, "It's important to get some rigor and make sure we're measuring things properly, because this is probably going to be a campaign issue in November."
Let's shift to other topics now and cover two new studies, starting with a RAND report that adds to the growing body of research on the relationship between military service and respiratory health. The authors analyzed survey data on the health and well-being of veteran and civilian populations who were of prime age for military service during different periods of national conflict: the Korean War, the Vietnam War, Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and the Global War on Terror. The findings reveal that both veterans and their civilian peers had similar respiratory health profiles during their 20s and 30s. But at older ages, veterans had worse respiratory health profiles than civilians did. For instance, compared with civilians over the age of 60, veterans over the age of 60 had higher rates of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, lung cancer, functional limitations caused by poor lung health, and activity limitations caused by poor lung health. The authors estimated that differences in smoking behaviors, including differences prior to enlistment, account for at least half of the veteran-civilian disparities in respiratory outcomes. This suggests the need for smoking cessation efforts among service members and veterans. However, it's also important to gain a better understanding of other factors that might negatively affect veterans' lung health, such as environmental exposures during military service.
For nearly 3 years, RAND researchers have been tracking the number of people experiencing homelessness in three Los Angeles neighborhoods: Hollywood, Skid Row, and Venice. In addition to counting individuals, the authors have conducted surveys of unsheltered residents in these same neighborhoods to better understand the characteristics, experiences, and needs of the population. Here's an overview of the latest findings. In 2023, the number of unsheltered residents in these neighborhoods remained stable, a notable change from late September 2021 through 2022, when the rate of growth was approximately 10% annually. In areas that had substantial encampment resolution activities, encampment clearings, for example, temporary declines that lasted 2 to 3 months on average were observed within the unsheltered population. More than half of survey respondents reported a chronic mental health condition. About half reported a chronic physical health condition, and a similar number reported a substance use disorder. About half of survey respondents reported being on the streets for 3 years or longer. and about two-thirds of respondents were actively looking for housing. About half of survey respondents reported recent engagement with a homelessness outreach worker or case manager. And finally, on average, 10% of survey respondents reported being employed. Three-quarters had an income of less than $600 per month. The study's lead author, Jason Ward, notes that these findings do indicate some progress in slowing the growth of unsheltered homelessness in Hollywood, Skid Row, and Venice. However, it's also clear that unsheltered residents remaining on the streets have significant mental and physical health needs that aren't being addressed.
That's it for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today, check out the show notes at rand.org/podcast. We'll see you next week. RAND is a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis.